TFM.
Welcome, Boomers, to another episode of Warp 5, our dedicated Star Trek Enterprise podcast. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me, as he always is my esteemed co-host, Matthew Rushing. And Matthew, I brought you a jar of treats today. They look like gummy worms. You want to try some?
No? I'm good. I think they're moving. So I tend to stay away from, food that moves. I'm not Klingon, Chris. You remember that, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, this looks like something you'd find in a Klingon candy shop. And the funny thing is...
Yes, it does.
I only had a few of them on the way over here, but I passed through a field of Omicron radiation, and now I've got this whole big full jar of them for you.
That is way more of them than there were just a few minutes ago. Maybe we just put that to the side for a moment.
Yeah, I don't think I want to eat those either. So anyway, everyone, we're going to continue not eating gummy worms today, but talking about the next episode in season 3 of Star Trek Enterprise as we continue our 20th anniversary rewatch. This is episode 7, The Shipment, and here is a quick rundown. With deployment of the Zindi superweapon just weeks away, the Enterprise follows a tip from Hoshi's almost boyfriend, Tarkin, and visits a planet where Zindi arboreals are refining chemosite. The mineral will be used in the construction of the weapon, something the facility's primary technician, Graylik Durr, claims to be unaware of when confronted by Archer. He agrees to help the humans by sabotaging the final shipment. Meanwhile, Trip, Phlox, and T'Pol take apart Zindi reptilian guns and discover that they are powered by worms. All right, well, Matthew, I guess a good place to start with this one actually is the way it opens, and that's the continuity element of it, because, of course, we've been getting continuity in this season, but last episode we talked about how it felt like we made a pit stop, sort of broke the momentum of the story, but they actually use that pit stop to kick off this one, where Hoshi's telepathic friend allowed them to go find this guy Durr in this processing facility. So that was one nice element of it. And then overall, I would say it just really, it does a lot of significant work to advance the overall story.
No, I agree with you on that point. I think that's one of the, as we were talking about Exile last time, obviously both of us were just like, but that really is then the thing, like you said, they utilize that to bring us to where we end up in this episode. And I think, that's, in some ways that's nice, that previous episode then is not a waste for all of us, that spending that time there actually mattered. And then moving right into this episode, I mean, it makes it really fascinating, because this is like Malcolm even says it, right? There's a moment in this episode where Malcolm's like, "Congratulations, sir. When we started this mission, we didn't know anything about the people who are trying to do this or trying to destroy our way of life and our planet. And now look where we are." And to me, I find that fascinating. It's really a huge movement for the story that we're in this place already. I mean, and the crazy part is that this is so early in the season too. Like there's a lot of movement that happens here really quickly with the story early, right? This is very early. That's one of the things that actually, as I was rewatching the episode, I had to go back and kind of look at how many more episodes there are left. And I was like, wow, we truly are kind of exploring some interesting territory very quickly at the beginning of the season. And so, you know, yeah, that continuity is fascinating in that sense.
Although what's interesting about that is it's episode 7, and by today's standards, we would already be nearing the end of the season for a TV show. And here, we're not even a third of the way through yet because there are 24 episodes. So, yeah, about Exile, of course you can look at it, and I guess this is how you should look at it. The story mattered because it set them on course to find this facility. At the same time, Archer and Tripp could have just found the coordinates for this planet scratched into the exterior of the sphere while they were there, you know, like someone had landed there and done a little bit of graffiti. You know, there are other ways that they could have found this planet and found this guy Durr without having to have the whole pit stop at the castle. Yeah. So there are different ways you can look at it. But since we do have the other episode, you know, I think it's better to just look at it as, okay, yes, there was value in that stop and in that part of the story. But I do like the fact that this episode doesn't continue to slow things down, but rather it sort of supercharges the search for the weapon. And I think there's a lot going on in this episode. So it's very rich in terms of not only the action that's happening, the things that are being discovered, the players that are involved, but we also see how Archer's view of the situation changes. And we also get a lot of world building here.
Yes.
Just to talk about the world building for a moment, we learn here that there was a sixth Zindi species, the Avians, and that they're now extinct. We also learn that the Zindi fought a war for close to a century, almost destroyed each other. And then two factions decided to try to tackle the geologic instability of the planet, which resulted in the destruction of the planet. And that's a whole background on top of getting to know this arboreal Durr and what he's like as a person, that it takes us beyond the initial setup of, okay, here's a species, the Zindi, who have five distinct races within the species that they work together now, but they also don't like each other. So it's, I think we talked about this probably at the beginning of the season, of how it's sort of, it's like Earth in a bottle, right? We're taking on what we face here on Earth and compressing that down into one adversary, or at least alien world that we're dealing with the story. But beyond the concept of it, here we're starting to really learn details that bring them to life and make us really question whether they are what we think they are.
Yeah, I mean, that's when I was referencing how quickly it felt like for a Star Trek season that is kind of having this type of continuity. Like, oh wow, we're already going to let the audience in on the enemy we think is the enemy might not truly be the enemy, or at least they might not all be the enemy. And to me, that was the thing that really stood out to me in this episode, is that we challenge our preconceptions then as our Starfleet crew of who's to blame for this, and then who we're going to take our frustration out on as we complete this mission. And that's the most Star Trek discussion you can have, because what it does is that it creates a lot of nuance then for this story. And I find that to be really fascinating. I think it's really good then that we're going to talk about that, because it does leave you in this place after you finish the episode where you're not quite sure exactly how to feel, right? And to me, that's really interesting, because you're so far, these people are just the enemy, and they need to be taken out. And now we're in a spot where, oh, well, maybe that's not quite the case. Maybe we don't have all the facts. Maybe this is going to turn out to be a completely different mission than we thought it was going to be. Or maybe it won't, but we don't know yet, because now everything we thought we knew has kind of been thrown into, it's almost like it's been thrown out the airlock, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that's all encapsulated in Durr and his story here, and also Archer, and especially with Durr, because at the very end of the episode, after Degra reveals what they're using the chema site for, mm-hmm. and tells him that there's this alien race that's going to destroy us if we don't destroy them first, and then for a moment, Durr wonders if he's been played by Archer.
Right.
And then at the end, he and Archer agree to trust one another. But you know, there's still this little bit of doubt in Durr's head about, well, okay, I'm going to trust this human, but, you know, maybe Degra, a fellow Zindi, is telling me the truth after all. Really don't know. And I think that's, you know, it's what we're left with too. When we look at the Zindi, like, we don't really know what to think anymore, who to trust. And at this point in the story, we don't know that the Zindi are being played by someone, right? Yeah. That hasn't come in yet. So,
well, and that's one of the things, because Archer says in this episode, you know, they've been told.
Mm-hmm.
So we have the sense that, like, okay, who's telling who?
What? Oh, right. Yeah. Right? We know someone has told them.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And which is, that's really fascinating then, because at the same time, then, like you said, it adds to all of the complexity, and it really does throw, I think, everything into question. Do we know the truth? You know? Mm-hmm. And this is where I think that question of the truth of the matter, and not just from our point of view, but the actual truth, mm-hmm. comes into play. And until we have that, we could be in real trouble, mm-hmm. because we could be blaming the absolute wrong people for this, or we could be reacting to them in a way where we're going to blame all of them as if all of them are responsible.
Mm-hmm.
And that could not be true. And so, again, this is one of those things where I think this is this episode. Again, I was just kind of shocked. Okay, we're gonna go there already in the 10th episode of the season. And then what's going to be so interesting is that there's a lot of season left. And those questions then are going to continue to be asked and answered as, you know, we move forward with the rest of the season, mm-hmm. For Archer and for different Zindi that we run across.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the whole thing about blaming another group, I think, is a bit of commentary that's timely right now, because it's very easy to just look at other groups, lump everyone in, anyone who you think even remotely might share the views or sentiments of a certain group. You just lump everybody together, put up a wall, then there's no communication. Yeah. You can't find a solution to anything. And you end up taking actions that are not only harmful to an entire other group of people, but also detrimental to yourself. And the other thing about the commentary that I find interesting is that this season, of course, it's well known that it was in part a reaction to the September 11th terrorist attacks. And in that case, what humans and Zindi represent here, of course, are the two sides of that conflict, looking at each other with hatred and suspicion and vengeance in mind and so forth. And carry that forward to today, and it's sort of the same situation that we're seeing in the world, except instead of it being two groups like we had in that conflict with the terrorist attacks on the U.S. and then the U.S. involvement in Afghanistan, all this stuff with Al-Qaeda and such, it's the within our own society, like we're creating these similar conflicts that sort of mirror that mistrust and that kind of acting on bad information and so forth. That so it's sort of a similar situation, but on like a global scale versus a smaller kind of internal scale, which I see that mirrored in it when I watch it. And I find it interesting how not only are conflicts like this cyclical in history, but they also can take other forms.
Well, I mean, I think there's a really interesting aspect to this where, you know, when we do the thing where we paint with a broad brush, which is interesting because, right, Star Trek is almost actually known for this broad brush painting.
Yeah, it kind of is, right?
And mainly that's because most of the races that we meet are so broad brushly painted. And it really wasn't until I think, you know, that Ronald D. Moore came in on The Next Generation and really started to create a Klingon culture that was unique and different and had some nuance to it that began to change. And then, of course, we've talked about many times, Deep Space Nine really takes that on and works very diligently to make that happen for all of the races that it deals with. And I think Enterprise does that too, right? From the very beginning, it says, yeah, you thought you knew Vulcans, but they weren't always what we thought they were, at least what we learned they were in the original series. There was a process for them to get to where they were, so we were going to do that from the beginning. And now with the Zindi, we're not going to just treat them as a monolithic enemy. We're going to treat them as a fully realized race where, you know, you could have somebody just doing their job and not realizing that that job is actually going to lead to the extermination of another race because they just didn't ask any questions, right? And and so I find that to be incredibly interesting. And it's one of the things where I think, you know, this season of Enterprise shows that it is willing to have a nuanced discussion of the issues. And I think that's great.
I think that nuanced discussion was necessary at the time that this was written because there was such an outrage over what had happened. And it was so easy to just say anybody who's Muslim, Islamic faith, anything dealing with those people who are not like us, the people who would be saying that, that can lead to very bad situation for society. And so having someone speak up and say, hey, we need to look at situations like this with more nuance was important at the time. And I think Star Trek is the ideal vehicle to do that. And so the writers did a good job of that here.
No, I mean, I think the way in which they deal with it is great. And the hard part about that is, too, is that, you know, obviously this is a response to 9/11 as a season. But, I mean, you also think back historically, right? You think back to, you know, Nazi Germany and, you know, people who their excuse was, oh, I didn't know. You didn't know that people were being burned in a concentration camp that's like 3 miles away from you and you could smell it and you just never asked. So that's the thing that I think that's, it's great about this, right? Because there is a lot of historical nuance to this. And that's one of the reasons why you can kind of see both, you know, Archer and Durr be cautious here. And yet the willingness to trust is something to which I think, you know, sets then Archer, even though Archer is closer to us in time period, it kind of sets him also apart from us as well. Because there, we've already seen places where Archer's kind of willing to basically go all Janeway on people. And That's a you know, throwback to when we'll be doing those things on To the Journey. But you know, what's interesting is that we push Archer to those limits in this show, and especially this season.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a moment where, even though 7 million people have been killed on Earth, so much hasn't happened yet in this that he's not willing to actually trust a little bit,
mm-hmm.
Which I find really interesting because, you know, if this happens later on in the season, I don't know if this happens, right?
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
And so that's what I find. I mean, that's what, again, the world building, the continuity of the season so far, and just how we're kind of dealing with Archer and his angst
mm-hmm.
and feeling the weight, right?
Mm-hmm.
If I don't stop this weapon, my people could be extinct forever, basically.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a real true fear. And, yeah. and I think that's the thing. Again, the nuance here is that they never cover over any of these issues, but they also show what could happen if two people are willing to lean into trust, you know, mm-hmm. and that's a hard thing. So. Yeah.
Well, and talk to each other.
Yeah.
just that most basic thing, which is often something that doesn't happen these days. But yeah, I mean, speaking of Archer, you mentioned earlier Reed's comment to Archer about how far they've come already on this mission. And that triggers Archer. So at the beginning of the story, Archer's very driven. You can tell he's frustrated that they haven't found more yet. He feels the clock ticking. And now they're here. They've got a lead. He's very driven. He's very angry and aggressive with Durr when he first mm-hmm. finds him. But, you know, Reed's comment also triggers something in Archer where he realizes that if he doesn't take a measured approach, then he's just showing the Zindi that humans are exactly who they think humans are.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think that that's one of the things that makes this a Star Trek story as opposed to the same type of story in another franchise or a standalone TV show or movie or something, is that it would be very easy to just write Archer as this leader who's determined to find the weapon at all costs and stop the Zindi at all costs. But he stops himself. You know, there's something that goes off in his head, like, wait a minute, what am I doing? Like, of course I have to stop the weapon, but, you know, how much can I sacrifice? And if I do it at any cost, is it really worth it ultimately for the human race?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and that's the kind of question that continues to get asked as we get further and further into the season, because the tension keeps getting ratcheted up mm-hmm. on Archer. The tension and the weight of what is being asked of him to have happen continues to kind of get worse and worse, and mm-hmm. so he gets more and more desperate. And mm-hmm. I think the beauty of that is that it makes complete sense when you think about what is at stake. And again, that's where I think, you know, that the season is doing a good job of that so far, especially when it comes to Archer and the task that has been laid before him is one that nobody would want. And mm-hmm. no human at this point in history has been tasked with basically, if you don't do this, then we all die.
Mm-hmm.
We cease to exist as a species. And so I find that to be just incredibly interesting. And again, we'll see how, you know, obviously the story progresses, but I think especially this episode lets us know that we are going to ask these big questions and we are going to deal with these big questions, and we're going to do it honestly and interestingly, but we're going to do that with nuance. And mm-hmm. that's going to make for, I think, a much more interesting story then.
Yeah, definitely. I did want to mention the chemosite itself. Within Star Trek, chemosite has appeared a few other times. So if you remember in Little Green Men on Deep Space Nine, chemosite is what Quark was trying to smuggle to the Orions on his shuttle when they were going to drop Nog off at Earth. And then also in Voyager, in Equinox, there were 2 kilotons, I believe it is, of chemosite on the Equinox, and they were going to transfer that over to Voyager. And at that point, the implication is that Starfleet ships use chemosite as for something. I mean, as Durr tells us in this episode, there are countless uses for chemosite, but
it takes care of like warts. It takes care of aches and pains.
Yeah. It's also good against the miracle dandruff. Drug.
Yeah, it's amazing for dandruff. Chris, I haven't had it since I started using the chemosite shampoo.
Head and Shoulders. Yeah.
It's fantastic.
But I don't think that was an intention of this story to suggest a setup for chemosite in the future. Mm-hmm. And the spelling was different in the later scripts, although it has been said that it's actually intended to be the same substance. What I think is, if you want to do a retcon here, what I find interesting is that you could draw a line from the discovery of the use of chemosite by the Zindi here. Archer discovers it, the Enterprise discovers it, and finds uses for it that then later, centuries on, Starfleet starts to use. So this could be a seed for Starfleet technology later on that stems from the excursion into the expanse to stop the Zindi weapon.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the other thing here that I did want to talk to you about, which we were joking about at the beginning, is what I call gunny worms. And these are the little organic worms or grubs or something that are powering the Zindi reptilian weapons, so that the gun. So we have this whole storyline about the gun in the episode, which actually takes up a fair bit of time in this story for something that, for the story itself, really doesn't have any connection to what's happening down at the refinery and trying to either stop the chemosite shipment or what they ultimately do of tagging it so they can track it later. Although it does play into the overall story arc of needing to find a way to deal with these weapons when they encounter them. But near the end, when they're hiding out in the forest or near the caves, and these little seeker drones come and they shoot one, and when they go up and they look closely at the scraps of the seeker that they've destroyed, you also see like these long worms coming out of that as well.
Yeah.
And I just thought that was, it was very interesting for a franchise that's been writing stories for this long. Of course, we got the biogel packs on Voyager, but this was a case where I thought they came up with an interesting new little idea for a weapons technology that wasn't just a rehash of something we've seen before.
No, I agree. I thought that this was really cool. And it kind of made sense to expand things, you know, for Star Trek. I'm really glad that they did. You know, this is one of those places, I think, where Star Trek is one of those shows sometimes where it does kind of get stuck in its own self. And this really allowed us then to be able to experience something new and interesting and different, and to realize, yeah, not every race just does things the same way. Different parts of the galaxy have different things to them, different technologies. And, you know, so yes, to kind of see that they have embraced this type of bioengineering is really interesting, which this just came to mind. I think makes sense when you have a culture of 5 different species that are all linked together, and yet they're all different, and they all evolved on the same planet. And so then to think of the fact that bioengineering might be something that they would be involved in is makes perfect sense, right?
Mm-hmm. And it's also interesting that, you know, it's not clear from what we see here if this is some life form. Again, it could be larva, like a grub worm or something that exists on the planet that generates power, and they found a way to use it. Because the implication here is that these weapons never run out of power. So Starfleet phasers and phaser rifles and such have to have an energy cell, which never seems to run out of energy unless it's convenient for the plot, for the gun to not work anymore. But right. the implication here is that if something happens to one of these worms, another one just grows. And so it endlessly replenishes itself. And I just thought as a science fiction concept, that it was a pretty interesting little element of the story that doesn't actually have anything to do with the key plot mm-hmm. of the story.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And it is something like, I think an interesting question then for us to ask as we, you know, move throughout the season, then does this ever come back? I think that's a good thing to try and remember to track.
Yeah, definitely. Because I'm trying to think right now if it ever does, and nothing is standing out to me at the moment of that. I think we see the weapons again, but whether they like delve into the actual functioning of these worms that power the weapons, I'm not sure that.
I agree. Plays
into it again. So, yeah.
The last thing that I was just thinking of, and really this is just kind of in closing, was this is one of those places where you can see how if this was a season of television today, that this would have moved them much closer because they would have been actually able to follow the tracker. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they had to do that because they still have, you know, 15 more episodes or whatever left of the season. Mm-hmm. And so they can't do that here. That's one of the places where I think the episode does kind of become slightly frustrating there at the end, because we take away all the work that we just did for the most part. And yes, the episode still allowed us to learn some really interesting stuff, especially just about the Zindi themselves, and that, you know, there are Zindi out there that are not the bad guys, which is all mm-hmm. great, you know. And yet, I still think all the hard work we went to try and track them and all, that part's slightly frustrating. But, you know, otherwise, I think this is a really good episode of the season. And as we said, the reason it's a good episode is because it adds a lot of shading. We've taken this from almost a black and white season now mm-hmm. to a shade of gray. And who knows if there's going to be 50 shades of gray or not, but it's definitely not going to be what we thought it was.
Yeah.
And that is really, I mean, again, that's just great Star Trek storytelling in general, right? I mean, that's what you want from a good Star Trek season, I think. So, mm-hmm. I really like this episode. I think I'd probably give it 4 out of 5 gunny worms, maybe.
Well, don't worry. You'll have 5 soon, because one of them will grow back.
Yes, that's true. Exactly. They just keep coming back, John.
Yeah. Well, I will say whether there will be 50 Shades of Grey will depend on how many more decon chamber scenes we get this season. But one last thing I'll note in final thoughts about this episode is that it does show Endure how you have people who are just going about their lives and doing their jobs, and they're unwitting accomplices in something bigger, because they don't really know that what they're doing is a piece in the construction mm-hmm. of a bigger plan. And that's where I think that making it very clear, very clear, because he repeats it in several ways in the episode, making it very clear that there are so many uses for chemosite, that this isn't something like, on the one hand, it feels kind of like an analogy for uranium, It has to be very purely refined.
Yes.
To be used in a weapon.
That's a good point, yep.
But they make it clearer that it has countless uses. So he doesn't know that it's being used for a weapon. It could be, who knows, maybe it's used to make toothpaste. Who knows, right? It could be for anything. And I'm glad that they make that clear in the episode because it makes Durr a much more sympathetic character that you can trust that he doesn't realize what he's doing. And it also makes it easier for him to decide to try to help and try to stop people from being killed because he himself is shocked to learn how the chemocide is being used.
Right. Yeah, and exactly.
So that's an element of the story that I am glad that they made clear. And they didn't just equate chemocyte with uranium. Even though the facility itself looks a little bit ominous, it is just an industrial facility. It's not necessarily something designed for the manufacture of weapons. So, I think this is a very good episode. I think the writing is good. Of course, the acting is excellent. And the nuance is there that makes it really feel like Star Trek. And so I'm going to give this one 8 seismic fissures.
Oh.
All right, everyone. We would love to hear your thoughts on The Shipment. There are many ways for you to share those with us. Perhaps the easiest way is to go to Facebook and join the Babel Conference. That is our listeners group. It's there to extend the conversations beyond the podcasts. So if you're joining for the first time, please do answer the questions and agree to the rules of the forum so that I can let you in. You'll find a post for this episode there on the timeline, and you can share your thoughts with Matthew and me and fellow listeners right there. You can also send us email, go to our website, trek.fm/contact, use the form you find there, choose to send to a show and choose Warp 5, and that will come to Matthew and me in a modified chemocyte container smuggled off the planet. And of course, you can find us in social media. Our username everywhere is TrekFM. And if your podcast app of choice allows you to leave a rating and a review, we'd love to get that from you as well. Now, Matthew, when you're not sniffing things to find out if they're organic or not, where can people find you?
Well, you can find me all over social media under the name MattRushing02. Of course, here on the network outside of all the Star Trek talk we do. You can find me in the 602 Club talking about all those other franchises we love. Then over on the Nerd Party Network, got a couple of shows. One is called Outpost, talking about every single chapter of the Harry Potter series. And then you can find me on Aggressive Negotiations with John Mills as we talk about Star Wars each and every week. But Chris, when you're not trying to figure out if those worms reproduce in your stomach after you eat them, where can people find you?
As long as I don't drink my Omicron radiation shake, I'll be all right.
Yes, yes. I love following things up with an Omicron radiation shake.
Yeah. It's delicious, but sometimes you should just pass on that. But
it's true.
When I'm not doing that, you can find me elsewhere on the network doing all the various shows with you. You can also find me in many episodes of many shows in the back catalog. And if you'd like to chat in social media, you can find me everywhere. My username is C Brian Jones, letter C, and Brian with a Y. And I'd love to talk to you there about Star Trek or whatever you want to chat about, even worms. And if you'd like to help us keep this rewatch and everything we're doing on the network going, we could definitely use your help. To find out how to support the show and support the network, please visit patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm. We would not be here without your help. So thank you to everyone who is supporting us now. Well, Matthew, next time I'll meet you in the future as we talk about Twilight.
Well, Chris, I can't wait for that. It's my favorite time of day. So let's go.